Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal by taking a look at the biz page. Quick glance at Triangle happenings. So, youth hockey takes a spotlight in the heading Cool Kids. As the Carolina Hurricanes get ready to start the regular season, the junior club is getting ready to host one of the most prominent junior hockey tournaments in North America. The organization that represents the junior group is playing host to the 5th annual NHL Youth Cup for the 2007-2005 and the 2003 birth year players, October the 7th through the 9th. The tournament will comprise some 325 of the best junior players in the country across 18 teams. The games will be played at the Polar Ice House in Wake Forest and the Raleigh Center Ice, with the three championship games scheduled for October the 9th at PNC Arena. Alongside the Junior One Canes this year, the youth teams will represent affiliates from the New York Islanders, the Philadelphia Flyers, Pittsburgh Penguins, the Columbus Blue Jackets, the Nashville Predators, the Florida Panthers, and the Washington Capitals. Dan Hollis, president of the Raleigh Youth Hockey Association, says this is a big win for the local association and youth hockey in North Carolina. This will be the largest Tier 1 AAA tournament ever hosted in our USA Hockey affiliate, he adds. The NHL's Hurricane open regular season play October the 7th. Go Junior Canes! And for those who might be interested in B&B, here's the heading, Book a Room and a Place for Dinner, too. Airbnb is moving past room rentals in Raleigh. The California company is teaming up with Resy to allow Airbnb guests to book reservations at Triangle Area restaurants through the Airbnb app. It's a service Resy is powering in 16 areas across the country. Restaurants participating in Raleigh include Death and Taxes and Standard Foods. According to Airbnb, its guests spent an estimated $5 million at Raleigh area restaurants over the past year. And in the opportunities section on the biz page, small towns mean big business for Triangle firms. Garner opened its new town hall on September the 19th, and biz is starting to see a trend. The rapid growth around the Triangle means many communities that were once small towns are now exploding with people. That means towns need more police, more firemen, more schools, and more space. And for companies like Resolute Building Company in Chapel Hill, that means more business. The Garner Town Hall, a $7.5 million project that covers 26,000 square feet, was one of several government projects being done by Resolute, which has 38 employees. Director of Business Development Tony Jordan says Resolute is one of several Triangle firms its size benefiting from projects of that scale. What you see with the mid-sized general contractors is we play in the same sandbox, he said. It's no secret that apartments and mixed use is booming, but Jordan says so is government work. We bid 4 libraries in the past 6 months, he says. Jordan says Resolute is working on roughly $40 million in projects a year, with a steady mix of apartments and public projects. The communities demand it, he says, of government work. Just like they want new supermarkets, they want new government buildings and schools. And in the heading New Spot comes the article, Credit Union Tries to Muscle into Tough Triangle Market. It's no secret the Triangle is a hot market for banks, and a smaller credit union based out of Charlotte is looking for a bigger presence here. Carolina's Telco Federal Credit Union, which has 40,000 members, has purchased a small location at the corner of Creedmoor and Millbrook Roads. Director John Gentry III of Raleigh says the credit union started out serving AT&T employees, but now serves employees and families of technology companies. The firm has 7 locations in Charlotte and several others around the Carolinas, in addition to leasing a location in Raleigh. The new location officially opens October 19th. We're trying to grow here, says Gentry. We feel like we need to have a presence in town. And under the good health heading is the article, Let's Celebrate Vaccinations. It's time to celebrate not getting the flu. As it turns darker earlier and temperatures drop, There's another memento of colder months we have to look forward to, the flu. But the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, in partnership with Sequiris in Holly Springs, wants to help. They're hosting a flu shot clinic, vaccination, and celebration at NC Biotech on October 17. While the event's about remaining healthy, it's also about promoting science. The event will feature Sequiris' production of the newest generation of flu vaccine, known as Flucelvax quadrivalent. NC Biotech calls the vaccine game-changing because the cell culture process is faster than the traditional method of growing vaccines in poultry eggs, and it does not contain antibiotics or preservatives. Now from the technology and banking page comes the article, CEO Lessons from Building a Blackboard. Today, Michael Chasen is the CFO of Raleigh drone developer PrecisionHawk. But in 1997, he was the founder of a company that would become Blackboard and be acquired for $1.7 billion. On stage at the Council for Entrepreneurial Development Technology Venture Conference in Raleigh on September the 20th, he shared some tidbits he learned along the way. First, be passionate about what you do. Be passionate about what you do, even if others aren't, he said. He posted two emails. In one, he's being thanked by an educator. In another, he's being insulted. Thanks for helping me take the fun out of college, the email read. Second, focus on the business and not the office. When starting Blackboard, the founders got permission to use computers from their former employer. Chasen recalled wheeling the computers out of the building on chairs and keeping those too. Chairs are expensive. We had maybe $1,000 between the two of us, he said. The chair he stole, which he still uses, reminds him of how scrappy we were in the beginning. Third, share the vision of your company. You never know who's going to help you, he noted. Look, if someone's going to steal your idea, there were no barriers to entry anyway. And lastly, constantly seek advice, but be the expert. He remembered pitching the firm as a product company to a venture capitalist. The venture capitalist across the table said, "That's ridiculous. You shouldn't be building a services company," he recalled. After leaving, he drove across town to another venture capitalist and pitched the firm as a services company. And from the subsection on the record is John Doerr's best one-liners at CED Tech. John Doerr, a senior partner at Silicon Valley's Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Brayers, is one of the country's best-known venture capitalists. He says the next technology wave will be AI. It was among a plethora of topics he covered at the Council for Entrepreneurial Development's Technology Venture Conference in downtown Raleigh on September the 19th, his first public appearance in North Carolina. It's a really hard thing to start a new business. It's the hardest thing I've seen people do in their lives. If you're going to start one, start a big one. The science is clear. We're dangerously close to an irreversible, cataclysmic climate crisis. It's the existential threat to our generation. While a public, profitable green technology company doesn't yet exist, not Tesla, not the solar panel makers, Doerr believes we're on the verge of seeing that happen. What about the topic of immigration? Let's take our fine universities and open them to the best and brightest all over the world. Let's have everyone compete for these positions, and then, after they've earned an advanced degree, let's tell them to leave, he mocked. The sooner we can fix that kind of brain damage and staple a green card to the diploma of every student, that's the way we're going to make America great. What about on diversity? The data's really clear, really clear. Diverse groups make better decisions. Diverse teams execute better. The sooner we get the technology world, the VC world, to a 50-50 world like the one we live in, the better we're going to be as a state, as a company, as an entrepreneur, as a company. He warned founders to wake up and hire women early, or otherwise they'll see the lack of inclusion on the team, and it will be impossible to recruit them in the future. And lastly, on North Carolina. You've got to get your state legislature more functional. You can do this. You really can. And if you get a functioning democracy here, I can't wait to see what would happen. And in the legal battle front, the article, Yadkin fires back against former employees' discrimination charges. 2 months after a former employee accused it of gender and age discrimination in a court filing, Raleigh's Yadkin Financial and its new parent company, FNB Corporation, are denying the allegations. The bank claims its officers repeatedly informed Lisa Rogers, its former executive vice president and director of mortgage lending, that it wanted to retain her to manage FNB's mortgage sales in the Carolinas, contrary to what Rogers said in her July counterclaim. According to Yadkin, Rogers asked it to delay making her an offer until it had made offers to employees under her supervision. FNB said it offered her a job and substantial bonus. Rather than accept this generous offer, Ms. Rogers chose to surreptitiously and maliciously work with and on behalf of a competitor to unfairly recruit a team of bank employees by misappropriating and misusing the bank's information, reads the reply filed in NC Business Court on September the 15th. The reply is the latest filing in a string of court documents. They stem from a complaint Yadkin Bank filed March 6th, accusing Rogers and a group of other former executives of lying, stealing, and cheating. And on the transportation front, Go Triangle denied in bid for electric bus funds. The feds have rejected Go Triangle's application for a grant that could have brought electric buses to its Triangle fleet by the end of next year. In June, the local transit authority filed a joint application with Go Raleigh, Go Cary, and Chapel Hill Transit, asking for nearly $3.3 million through the federal Low or No Emission Competitive Grant Program. The cash would have covered about half the cost of buying 7 Proterra 40-foot electric buses, which cost about $980,000 each, with equipment. Mike Charbonneau, Go Triangle's Director of Marketing and Communications, emailed local offices September 18th that the agencies had been rejected. He added that going through the grant process has better prepared the local transit agencies to explore viable alternatives through additional funding and finance options moving forward. Now we turn to the Life Sciences page, and we have the article, Witte Brings Fresh Perspectives to Hatteras. Hatteras Venture Partners, which has about $450 million under management, has named former GlaxoSmithKline CEO Sir Andrew Witte a venture partner. Hatteras has a long-standing relationship with Sir Andrew Witte, says Clay Thorpe, general partner at Hatteras, even for the development of Hatteras. Bob Ingram, general partner at Hatteras, and a former Glaxo Welcome CEO, served as Witte's mentor while Witte was coming up the ranks at the pharmaceutical giant, Thorpe notes. Roughly a decade ago, Witte spoke at Hatteras' annual meeting, says Thorpe, and last year he gave a second talk at our annual meeting, and once he retired from GSK, we began a dialogue about what it might look like for him to have some kind of role with us, he said. We operate in a global market and a global healthcare economy, and Andrew has a really important perspective along those lines and will bring that perspective and strategic relationships he has accrued over his illustrious career. Additionally, Witte will focus on strengthening leadership at our portfolio companies and imparting wisdom to CEOs and board members of those companies, Thorpe says. Over the last 18 years, Hatteras has continued to grow, but hasn't seen its strategy change all that much, according to Thorpe. He says the company is looking for the next big breakthroughs with a large focus on academic science. We've grown in our ability to consider new opportunities and also to strengthen those with capital and strategic relationships, he says. Back in 2012, Hatteras made its first investment in Research Triangle Park-based GI Therapeutics, about $600,000, according to Thorpe. Earlier this year, GI raised about $108 million in its initial public offering. The company currently has a market capitalization of approximately $700 million. We'd like to see that kind of success in every company, says Thorpe, adding, however, that it's also important to take risks. Just a couple months following its IPO, GI added Witte to its board of directors. And in news on the surgery front comes the article about a surgical robot. FDA approval gets closer. Research Triangle Park-based Transenterix may be just within reach of a key approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The company announced on September 18th that it's filed a response to the additional information request related to the approval process for surgical robot Senhance. This response comes several weeks ahead of the company's original early fourth quarter response expectation, and in our view, should increase confidence in both the timing and probability of a potential 2017 U.S. Senhance approval, analyst Rick Wise at Stifel stated in a research note on September 18. While certainly not an absolute guarantee of approval, we do believe that TRXC's ability to rapidly answer the FDA Senhance letter suggests the questions were largely manageable, Wise added. Transenterix acquired Senhance from Italy's Sofar back in 2015, and the system already has CE mark approval across Europe. The company has better focused on Senhance for the better part of 2016 and this year after its Surgibot surgical robot system was denied approval by the FDA in April of 2016. President and CEO Todd Pope has said Transenterix would consider next steps for Surgibot's resubmission to the FDA following that of Senhance. Earlier this summer, Transenterix cracked the Japanese market, selling its first Senhance system there to a medical center near Tokyo. And in February, Transenterix sold a Senhance system to a hospital in Germany. The company reported revenue of $1.9 million for the first quarter of 2017, which it stated was primarily related to the sale of one Senhance during the quarter. It also raised upward of $23 million in an equity financing and secured up to $17 million in debt financing. Wise stated in his research note that Series A warrants and Series B warrants included in the equity financing, if exercised in full, could see proceeds total approximately $44 million and provide TRXC cash into late 2018. And on the clinical research front comes the article Roivant Turns to Local Expertise as It Launches New Data Company. After landing a $1.1 billion equity investment led by SoftBank Vision Fund, global biopharmaceutical company Roivant Sciences has launched a new data company and fielded some local expertise to help. Datavant, led by Silicon Valley-based Travis May, joins a list of drug development companies wholly or majority owned by Roivant. The new company, focused on using artificial intelligence to improve clinical trials, has recruited some Triangle expertise for its scientific and data advisory board. Roivant's research and development is largely based in Durham. Dr. Daniel Birch, Chief Medical Officer of PPD Biotech, and Dr. Frank Rockhold, Professor of Biostatistics and Bioinformatics at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, are both members of Datavant's new advisory board. And finally, on the life sciences front comes the article, Chapel Hill's Row to Add Jobs in the Coming Months. Contract research organization Row plans to add more than 40 employees in a few months. The growth is motivated by Row continuing to win more repeat business and also new clients, says co-CEO Russ Helms. The company has long kept a focus on employee retention in an industry widely known for turnover. It's beneficial to building client relationships when a CRO can put a team in front of a client where half of the team has been with the CRO for a decade or two, Helms says. Clients are sensitive to how well a team likes each other and respects each other, he adds. Some of Rowe's current headcount growth is catch-up growth, Helms says. The company, based in Chapel Hill, has more than 400 employees. Now turning to the news page. On the food scene comes the article, Fuquay Farina Chef to Open Eatery in Downtown Raleigh. For Hibernian Hospitality Group owner Niall Hanley, bagging a new artisan boutique butcher shop for his Morgan Street food hall and market was a big deal. Joseph Fazy, a well-known Triangle restaurant owner who operates the Hook and Cleaver Market on Broad in downtown Fuquay Farina, is going to open a second location at the Raleigh Food Hall next year. Called Hook and Cleaver on Morgan, Fazy's restaurant will feature fresh meats, seafood, and prepared foods. As we've looked to expand the Hook and Cleaver brand into the Raleigh market, I couldn't think of a better opportunity than Morgan Street Food Hall, Facey says. South Raleigh is considered a food desert by the USDA, and to bring our fresh, chef-inspired, local-focused market to this area is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Morgan Street Food Hall and Market, a 22,000-square-foot culinary incubator, is in the heart of downtown Raleigh's warehouse district, and it will feature more than 60 dining and retail stalls offering high-quality, chef-driven specialty foods with a wide range of diversity. The food hall is expected to open to the public in early 2018. The food hall already has commitments for 35 dining and retail stalls comprised of local chefs and entrepreneurs. With 35 years of experience, Facey has previously worked at the Biltmore, Hotel Sofitel, Le Cirque, and as the executive chef for the Stadium Hospitality Village at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. He also owns catering by Hook and Cleaver. And in news on the retail front comes the article, Raleigh Sewer Agreement Sets Stage for Wegmans. A developer agreement with the City of Raleigh regarding sewer infrastructure could be one of the last steps before a planned Wegmans grocery store breaks ground on Wake Forest Road. Site owner ITB Holdings went before the Raleigh City Council September the 19th, requesting a developer agreement with the city involving sewer main improvements. City staff wrote that the project would support Wegmans and also alleviate existing and future sewer capacity restrictions for an area where a considerable amount of redevelopment is occurring, according to the agenda item. Paul Manana, a senior leasing agent at Regency Centers, which is partnering with ITB Holdings to develop the project, explains that the area is at capacity when it comes to sewer. "This improvement isn't for us specifically. We're just the tipping point," he says. "We're just the project that substantiates the need and the appropriateness of increasing sewer capacity in that area." City Council unanimously approved the proposal. The goal is to have the utilities, grading, and other site readiness activities complete so that the building pad can be turned over to Wegmans while the developers continue working on the rest of the shopping center. Wegmans, the New York-based big box grocery chain, confirmed the new retail site last year. While the store originally planned to open in 2018, construction has yet to start as more approvals and permits are required to break ground. Wegmans spokesman Valerie Fox said in an email that the work was expected to start within the next 2 to 3 weeks, but declined to share a projected opening date. Wegmans will anchor the new Midtown East Retail Center, located at the 22-acre property that formerly housed an Alcatel plant. In addition to the 120,000-square-foot Wegmans, Midtown East will have a mixture of 6 smaller shop buildings with about 42,000 square feet of retail fronting Wake Forest Road. ITB Holdings acquired the property in 2003. Now we move to the page around the state. And there are a couple of articles here, both contributed by the Charlotte Business Journal. The first is Ally Financial to Anchor Uptown Charlotte Project. One of Charlotte's most anticipated mixed-use projects will finally break ground in the coming months, with Ally Financial signing on as the anchor tenant. Crescent Communities will begin construction on Ally Charlotte Center, a 26-story, 742,000-square-foot office building in the first quarter of 2018. Ally Financing is leasing 400,000 square feet as part of consolidation and expects to move in when the building delivers in early 2021. The 378-foot-tall building will be at 601 South Tryon Street. The building will be about half the height of the tallest building in Charlotte, which is the 60-story Bank of America Corporate Center. Jeffrey Brown, CEO of Ally Financial, said the company has been looking for a long-term home that could house all of its Charlotte employees. The Detroit-based financial services company currently keeps about 1,300 full-time employees and 400 contract employees in 3 different locations in Uptown, Ballantyne, and South Park. "This was a smart business decision and cultural decision," Brown said September the 19th. "Culture matters a tremendous amount at Ally. We're excited about getting all the Ally employees together and taking it to the next level. The site where Ally Charlotte Center will soon rise has been marketed as Tryon Place since it was first announced in 2013. But while the name has changed, the original goal of what was intended at Tryon Place 4 years ago has not, said Brian Leary, president of commercial and mixed use at Crescent Communities. Now that we have such a tremendous anchor with what Ally is going to do, we're going to focus on the office tower, he said. Initial plans call for a 27-story office tower, ranging from 500,000 to a million square feet, a four-story atrium with retail space, a large public plaza, and a hotel. Those features, including 30,000 square feet of retail and a 20,000 square foot pedestrian plaza, will remain at the new iteration of the project. Seven stories of above-ground parking with 1,400 spaces will also be developed, offering a parking ratio of about 1.5 spaces per 1,000 square feet. A hotel partner will be announced within the next several weeks, Leary added. We've had tremendous interest from the best owners and operators in this country, Leary said. He said the hotel would contain at least 300 rooms with meeting and conference space. Ally, which spun out of General Motors in 2006, is leasing a good chunk of the building for its corporate center. Ally's Charlotte employee base is about the same size as its Detroit headquarters. Brown sits in Charlotte, as well as the company's top bank executive, Diane Morels. And the second article from the Charlotte Business Journal on today's Around the State page is Raleigh Firm to Develop Hotel Project in Charlotte. Additional retail offerings on a 139-room aloft hotel are in the works for the Charlotte's City Park development. Raleigh-based MJM Group expects to break ground on that 77,000-square-foot hotel in early 2018, with the goal of completing it by year-end. Plans also call for 11,000 square feet of retail space split among the two buildings. City Park is a 170-acre mixed-use development located at the former Charlotte Coliseum property off Tavola Road. The Charlotte Airport submarket has enjoyed explosive growth, says Anuj Mittal, president and chief executive of the MJM Group, the owner and development of the project. The Shopping Center Group is the exclusive leasing agent. Negotiations are ongoing with local and national restaurant concepts to anchor those retail buildings at City Park, says Daryl Palaciano with the Shopping Center Group's Charlotte office. Aloft marks MJM's third hotel at City Park mixed-use development and sixth overall in the greater Charlotte market. The hotel and commercial real estate development company also operates Marriott International Flags Residence Inn and Fairfield Suite at that site. And now from this week's A Better World page comes the article, Nonprofit Looks to Connect Durham Students. Odds are good that 4 in 10 young people in Durham are not on track to finish high school, complete a post-secondary education, or get a job by age 25. To help find out why, a community-wide effort to help kids back on track tasks 25 local high school students with identifying the biggest barriers to success for young people. Those barriers, the students found, after a year of querying parents, teachers, and other students, are inadequate counseling and racial bias. The goal is to make sure all Durham kids finish public school and post-secondary study and get jobs, says Meredith Holmes, executive director of Made in Durham, the nonprofit that directed the students and is guiding a community effort to create an education-to-career system for young people ages 14 to 24. Made in Durham, founded in 2015, recruits partner organizations and helps organize and coordinate the way students get career-related support from those partners, businesses, schools, government, and nonprofits. It raises money for the overall effort, supports its work, and tracks its impact. Durham's future depends on making sure more students are ready to take on jobs in a highly competitive local marketplace driven by health and life sciences, Holmes says. And that will depend on the active and connected participation and support of all its partners, she adds. Students succeed when they see the connection between school and work, she says. connecting more businesses with students in and outside of school, will help more students see the real-world value of school. Recruiting more companies to create more internships, apprenticeships, and job shadowing programs will help set more students on the road to good local jobs, Holmes says. The nonprofit, operating with 5 employees and a board, advisory teams, and action teams that together field about 100 corporate and community leaders, raised a total of nearly $2.7 million in its first 3 years, and it aims to raise nearly $1 million this year. In 2015, Made in Durham worked with the city, public schools, and other partners for more than double to 200 the number of jobs in the city summer internship program, and to expand the program beyond mainly jobs in city and county government to include private sector jobs. Made in Durham also formed Durham Futures, a collaborative that now includes Durham Public Schools, Durham Tech, and 2 other nonprofits that together provide alternative education for about 250 school dropouts. Made in Durham was instrumental in a decision by the Durham Public Schools, starting with 9th graders this school year, to require that all students graduate within 4 years with a career plan and high school diploma, Holmes says. It also secured funding for 2 career counselors to work with students served by the 4 Durham Futures partners serving dropouts. For students exposed to career options and educated about them, schools are relevant, Holmes says. Without those resources or other motivation, schools become irrelevant, so many drop out, she says. Our goal is to make schools relevant. Now we turn to the page called Executive Voice, and this week's interviewee is Zach Morides. Zach Morides was an offensive lineman at Duke University in 2004, when, like many athletes trying to juggle their schedules, he found himself overwhelmed. So Morides found a solution and the foundation for a business. Now Teamworks is solidly planted in Durham with rising revenue and 65 employees. Duke's been a longtime client, but the list continues to grow, with University of Alabama signing on this past summer. Teamworks has more than 1,000 clients now. Teamworks products help sport organizations manage their athletes and employees and stay on track with the multiple demands that come with elite competition. So here's the Q&A. Tell us about your aha moment at Duke University. When I was an 18-year-old offensive guard at Duke, I struggled with time management while adjusting to college life. As a student athlete, I had 8 or 9 different admins all vying for my time, none of whom had visibility into my schedule. It was up to me to keep track of everything, juggling appointments, classes, team meetings, training sessions, and more. I ran a lot of stadium seats at 4 a.m. for being late or missing meetings simply because I was double booked or didn't get the update that a time had changed. The coaches, staff members and administrators, athletic trainers, academic advisors, nutritionists and doctors were doing their best, but all of their information was siloed. It wasn't until I was assigned a project to develop an app to enhance my daily life my sophomore year that I saw the opportunity to really tackle this issue. That's when I decided to create a platform to centralize information and promote shared communication, ensuring everyone within the program was on the same page all of the time. So, was there a key client that got this rolling? Teamworks wouldn't exist without Duke Athletics. They gave me the opportunity to really explore the cause of our team's communication issues and serve as the testing ground for the early product. So what did you learn from playing at Duke that helped you in business? Culture matters. A winning culture brings out the best in people. A losing culture brings out the worst. And in both business and sport, culture is destiny. As a leader, you must invest time every day to build and enforce a winning culture. So how many teams do you service now? We currently work with over 1,600 clients, more than 1,300 of which are Division I collegiate teams. So how much does the service cost? Our services are sold as an annual subscription, and the fee is dependent on the number of users, features requested, and the length of the agreement. On the lower end, smaller teams may spend a few thousand dollars, while larger teams, department-wide collegiate clients and governing bodies, may spend 5 or 6 figures annually. So what sets your service apart from other options? Today, our customers only have two other options: maintain the status quo, antiquated, inefficient processes, or use generic tools from companies that lack domain expertise and athletic operations. So what new services do you see coming from TeamWorks? We're constantly looking for ways we can bake domain expertise into the product. A recent example is our time management module, which helps our university clients comply with new legislation passed by the NCAA earlier this year. So what's a book you read that made a difference for you in business? Crossing the Chasm by Jeffrey Moore. It's been our go-to market playbook for the last 7 years. Do you anticipate remaining in Durham? Duke University was our laboratory. There's a great pool of tech talent here, and I love the city of Durham. It is and will continue to be TeamWorks' home. Name a failure that was educational. I've had too many failures to choose just one. What's important is failure is rarely fatal, and it's only a bad thing if you don't learn from it. A good habit I've developed is when a failure's fresh, I force myself to sit down while it's still fresh in my mind and document everything that I think went wrong. What would I do differently if given the chance? And how I can prevent this result in the future. Mistakes are okay. Repeating them is not. So why do you value simplicity? A simple product is easy to use. The easier it is to use, the more people engage with it. The more engagement, the greater the value to our clients. So how will you grow revenue? Currently, we're adding 3 to 4 athletic departments a month, meaning 3.2 teams per day. How's revenue grown? TeamWorks revenue growth is proportionate at 100% year over year. And finally, being Greek is part of your identity. How has that shaped what you do? My dad started a law firm and real estate business. When I was a kid, he always encouraged my sister and me to get an education, but said at the end of the day, it would be great to be in a position to run our own business. The entrepreneurial mindset has always been a part of my life, and being Greek, my grandparents did have a diner. Now from this week's small business page comes the article, When It Is Time to Think Outside the Family Business. And this is authored by James Lee, who's a family business speaker, author, and advisor. I've had a lot of conversations with families in business about the choices available to them when family ownership and management successions aren't going to work. In the minds of many people, if nobody in the family is able or willing to take over running the company, the only options are to sell it or shut it down. But maybe not. A number of senior owners of family companies who find themselves without a successor come up with ways to keep business ownership in the family, even if the management has to go outside. Think about the Midwestern family that has owned and operated a chain of small market newspapers for more than 170 years. The family, we'll call them the Smiths, has had very few internal business disputes, and no one has ever elected to cash out of the company. In addition, there's usually been a place in the business for any qualified and committed family member who applied. How have they managed that? Well, about 130 years ago, the widow of the founder's son found herself the sole owner of the growing business. She was unimpressed with the next generation's pool of management talent, including her own children. She also heard rumblings about splitting up the company so everyone who wanted his own newspaper could have it. Not a chance, said the gritty lady, and put the whole kit and caboodle into a trust. She made a provision that if the trust were ever broken, the company would have to be sold out of the family with the proceeds going to charity. And if that wasn't enough to scorch some bonnets, she also insisted that all future CEOs be hired by the trustees and that none of them be a family member. Today, the Smiths have a very profitable family newspaper publishing business, and they spend a lot of time singing great-great-grandma's praises. Another in the family, call them the Johnsons, reached the end of their successor string with a second generation of family owners. Instead of selling their manufacturing company, the family agreed to bring in professional management and hired an experienced executive as president. The Johnson family retained their representation on the board and a couple of upper-level management jobs, but they let the new CEO staff the executive suite with qualified people he could work with effectively, and they provided compensation, severance, and retirement packages for their outside executives that equal the industry standard and then some. The Johnsons will continue to own their company, confident that although management is out of family's hands, it's in good shape. Another family's last best hope for a family successor to take over the company that built to operate their 6 down-home restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area was their youngest daughter. But the daughter, who had worked in the business since she was 15, announced that she never wanted to cook another pot of greens as long as she lived and went off to law school. 2 national food service corporations had already made offers for the family company with plans to keep the restaurant's name, but standardize the menus and recipes to cut costs and appeal to a broader range of customers. The family knew that after standardization would come serving burgers out a side window, so they looked for a way to bring in new management while retaining family ownership of the business. When they tried to envision a dream team that knew their operation and had a stake in holding on to the traditions that had made it successful, they found themselves looking right at the roster of managers who had been running the individual restaurants for years. Well-trained, experienced, and used to working together, the store managers were a natural talent pool, and they were the next best thing to family. The family worked out ownership and profit sharing for the new president and other senior executives. The plan gave their best qualified employees a great chance to move into corporate management with a little equity to sweeten the deal, and it gave the family business a long new lease on life. The cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal is the 2017 Best Places to Work. And these are broken up by the size of the company, and there's simply too much information to read during the program, so let me simply give you the names of the companies in these categories. So under the heading of giant companies, we have 2. Red Hat, based in Raleigh, and Fidelity Investments, based in Durham. Now, in the extra-large companies, there are a large number of these. One is Rickabeen Associates Family Dentistry in Cary. 2 is Roe from Chapel Hill. 3 is SoftPro, based in Raleigh. That's a provider of real estate, closing, and title insurance company. 4th is United Therapeutics, based in RTP. That's a biotech company. 5th is a company, Bandwidth, based in Raleigh. They develop and deliver the power to communicate. 6 in the extra-large companies are Channel Advisor Corporation, based in Morrisville. That's an e-commerce cloud platform. 7th is BASF in Durham. That's a chemistry for a sustainable future. 8th, the Coastal Credit Union in Raleigh. 9th is Accenture in Raleigh. They provide services in strategy, consulting, digital technology, and operations. 10 is the company EY, based in Raleigh. They do assurance, tax transaction, and advisory services. Now, that ends all the extra large companies. Now, here are the large companies. 1 is DPR Construction in Morrisville. 2 is McAdams in Durham. They're a land planning, landscape architecture, civil engineering, and geomatics firm. 3 is Republic Wireless in Inc. in Morrisville. They're a nationwide network that uses Wi-Fi and cell. 4 is Stewart. They are a design, engineering, and planning firm based in Raleigh. 5, Research Square, based in Durham, and it is a research firm. 6, Coldwell Banker HPW in Raleigh. 7 is Bulk TV and Internet, also based in Raleigh. 8 is Withers Ravenel Incorporated, and that's based actually in Cary. It's a civil and environmental engineering firm. 9 is Sherry Beckert LLP, that's in Raleigh, and it's a public accounting firm. 10 is iContact in Morrisville. They do email marketing software solutions. 11 is the Bob Barker Company in Fuquay Varina. They are a detention supplier delivering products and service beyond expectations. 12 is the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency, based in Raleigh. They're a public agency that that finances available housing. 13, William Peace University, based in Raleigh, obviously a university. Now we move to the medium companies. 1 is Clean, based in Raleigh. It's a branding agency. 2 is BDO USA LLP, and they're a public accounting and consulting firm. 3 is Pendo, based in Raleigh. They're a software company. Number four, Automated Insights. They create Wordsmith, an open natural language generation engine, and they're based in Durham. Number five is Cushman & Wakefield, based in Raleigh. They're a commercial real estate company. Also based in Raleigh is Cardinal Solutions Group. Number six, they're a natural IT solutions provider, a national IT solutions provider that delivers solutions, strategic guidance, and training. Number seven in the medium companies is Personify. This is a recruitment solutions provider based in Raleigh. Number eight, also in Raleigh, is MassMutual North Carolina. That's a holistic financial services firm. Number nine is Ashton Woods in Raleigh. That's a residential home builder. Number 10 is In Motion Now, based in Morrisville. They provide workflow management solutions for marketing and creative teams. Number 11 is Principal Technologies out of Durham. They assess technology and fact-based marketing, and they do learning and development services. Number 12 is a construction firm, Brassfield & Gorey, based in Raleigh. Number 13 in the medium companies is Mako Medical in Raleigh. They focus on rare, difficult, and complex diagnostic testing. Number 14 is Accreditation Commission for Healthcare, based in Raleigh. They're a nonprofit accreditation organization. Number 15 is Liquidia in Marsville. They're a biopharmaceutical. Now under the small company headings is Pelnick Insurance in Cary. Number two, Jones Insurance Agents in Raleigh. Number three is Go Realty in Cary. Number four is Largemouth Communications in Durham. They're a public relations firm. Number five is Eckel and Vaughn in Raleigh. They are a strategic communications agency. Number six, Management Recruiters of Raleigh, and they do executive search and recruiting. Number seven is Frankel Staffing Partners in Raleigh. They recruit staff and place people. Number eight, based in Cary, is the Riley Contracting Group, obviously commercial general contractors. Number nine is the Ronald McDonald House of Durham and Raleigh, based in Durham. Number 10 is Level Homes, that's in Raleigh, and obviously they're a home builder. And that concludes the 2017 Best Places to Work. Now turning to the page simply titled The List, comes an interview with the NCHUB director. In fact, the article is titled Five Questions with the NCHUB Director. For those of you who may not know, the acronym HUB is Historically Underutilized Businesses, and this is in the North Carolina Department of Administration. So here are some questions. What initiatives are being developed and carried out to increase the level of HUB businesses in North Carolina? It's most important to invest in the growth and development of diverse businesses, which are the engines that drive our economy. Our team is committed to implementing policies that spur economic development in every corner of North Carolina and increase capacity among HUB firms. Those current initiatives include one-stop statewide uniform certification, which provides consistent alignment throughout the state for certification of firms that meet the criteria. Two, create a culture of trust and accountability by holding regular meetings with internal agency construction project coordinators to define best practices in meeting the state HUB goals, and regular meetings with internal agency procurement directors to strategically create inclusive policies that allow for second-tier participation in goods and services. And the third initiative, proactive partnerships. We keep in close contact with cabinet agencies to define opportunities in advance. This methodology allows HUB firms to mobilize and staff up accordingly. The office also provides training and development through business development initiatives in partnership with DOT. We require agencies identified by statute to report their HUB spending on a quarterly basis with the HUB office, and expect agencies with Connect NC bond projects to ensure strong HUB participation. Now the second question, how many designated HUB vendors are in your database, and what are you doing to actively engage those businesses? There are nearly 4,200 vendors currently HUB certified by our office. To actively engage firms, the office works collaboratively with partners such as NCDOT, universities, local governments, nonprofits, and private industry to share training and contract opportunities. The HUB office travels throughout the state providing how to do business with the state and certification workshops. Third question. What's your office done to eliminate hindrances to HUB businesses here in the state? The HUB office continues to educate and train managers relative to best practices to spur economic development across North Carolina. The office is focused on assisting management with strategies to unbundle projects to create right-sized opportunities that are more conducive to attracting HUB vendors as prime contractors. The Contractors College, offered throughout the HUB office, provides professional courses on bidding and includes estimating, understanding contracts, marketing, bonding, and opportunities to network. The fourth question, how did you end up on this career path? I worked on both sides of the aisle in Congress, and through collaborations with Minority Business Development Agency in Washington, D.C., developed an affinity for service to communities. After attending a White House HBCU initiative, I gained knowledge of North Carolina passage of the largest higher education bond referendum in the country, along with passage of the minority business legislation. I relocated to North Carolina to work with the UNC system in creating HUB programs and was directly employed by North Carolina Central University in the early 2000s. I now have the responsibility of leading the statewide initiative to set policies and guidelines that assist in growth and development of HUB firms. Last question. In your opinion, what's the best thing an HUB owner in North Carolina can do to enhance their business? My advice is to never be afraid to diversify to meet industry needs. One of my mentors told me early in my career to never close the door to an opportunity. I say to HUB firms, stay true to your core business integrity, but be willing to modify and adapt to current trends and offerings. Now moving to today's viewpoint page, comes the article, Hey Tech Giants, It's Regulation Time. The tech industry and Silicon Valley's dominant role as the home base of some of the biggest and most powerful companies in the world is under attack. And this has nothing to do with Apple coming out with a new iPhone that will set back the iOS-minded a cool grand. Over the past few days, there's been a stream of stories calling out the country's largest technology employers for being monopolies, engaged in unfair business behavior, or trying to stifle free speech or helping promote fake news. All this comes on the heels of revelations of sexual harassment or misconduct at high-profile companies and among high-powered investors. None of this is exactly new. Ever since Donald Trump moved into the White House, replacing the very tech-friendly Barack Obama and angering much of the industry's ruling class, things have been frosty. What's different is that Silicon Valley is getting hit from all sides now. Just look at these headlines, all of which were published this week, and you'll see a trend. So three headlines. One, conservatives and liberals unite against Silicon Valley. That's Politico. Two, there's blood in the water in Silicon Valley. That's from BuzzFeed. And three, how Silicon Valley is erasing your individuality. That's from the Washington Post. And the piling on isn't just happening on home turf. Here's a headline from the UK-based The Telegraph. Government signals end to tech utopia for Silicon Valley giants, with the government in question being that of British Prime Minister Theresa May. Several factors are at play for this anti-Valley hostility, not the least of which are critics in the media. Tucker Carlson, the Fox News primetime host, who also runs the conservative news site The Daily Caller, is on a crusade to treat Google as a public utility. Normally one who abhors government regulation of business, Carlson openly is calling for Washington to step in and regulate this one company. Google seems to be letting politics dictate who's allowed to make money from their platform, Carlson charged during one Fox News broadcast last week. Plenty of people in the Valley will no doubt brush off Carlson as just another right-wing pundit, angry at the tech industry's liberal political tendencies. But these are the same people who should be concerned about another media voice that's harder for them to dismiss. Franklin Foer, a staff writer for the Atlantic and a former New Republic editor-in-chief who's written the book World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. It's hard not to marvel at these companies and their inventions, which often make life infinitely easier, Foer wrote in a column in the Washington Post. But we spent too long marveling. The time has arrived to consider the consequences of these monopolies, to reassert our role in determining the human path. Tech giants don't like to think of themselves as monopolies. They prefer to cast themselves as dynamic, multifaceted corporations aimed at making our lives more productive and entertaining. But they're also highly competitive, acquiring smaller startups that have technology they covet, and becoming aggressive competitors against bigger companies that operate in a sliver of their universe. If they haven't already, these tech powerhouses should start preparing for an aggressive push from a Washington administration that loathes regulations and a media landscape that's starting to seriously question how they do business. And the author of this article is J. Jennings Moss, who's editor-in-chief for the Silicon Valley Business Journal. And to end our program today comes the announcements of people on the move. So we have a couple of new hires. Kelly Dietz, Director of Presidential Operations at William Peace University. Dietz manages the Office of the President and supports the President with communications, strategic engagement, board management, and the university's strategic plan. Dietz has 15 years of experience in university and public administration, focusing on advice and guidance for top-level officials. And a new hire, Babette Stone, Vice President and Director of Credit Administration at North State Bank. Babette has joined North State Bank as Senior Vice President and Director of Credit Administration, announced Brian Hedges, Executive Vice President and Chief Credit Officer. And finally, a promotion for Stacy Reedy to Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at North State Bank. On August 23rd, President and CEO Larry Barber announced the promotion of Chief Financial Officer Stacy Reedy to Executive Vice President. This promotion follows Reedy's move to the role of Chief Financial Officer in early 2017. Well, the music tells us that we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.